From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Frank McCourt captivated readers in 1996 with his first book, Angela's Ashes, a haunting and beautifully written memoir about a miserable childhood in Ireland. Angela's Ashes won the Pulitzer Prize. McCourt went on to write Tiz about his early days in New York. Now, at age 75, he's just published his third memoir, Teacher Man, about his 30 years in New York City schools. Frank McCourt took his first teaching job teaching English in 1958 at McKee Vocational and Technical High School on Staten Island. He ended his teaching career with years at New York's elite Stuyvesant High School. Then came Angela's Ashes, fame and fortune, and McCourt's views were sought on everything, he says, on Ireland and conjunctivitis and drinking and religion and hunger. Now he's turned around to look at teaching. This hour on Point, master storyteller Frank McCourt reflects on life, youth, career, and 30 years in the classrooms of New York. You can join the conversation. Have you discovered yourself, your humanity, your touch of the Irish in the memoirs of Frank McCourt? And what do you make of this man, his voice, his view of life and the world that has captured so many millions of fans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco is Frank McCourt. His first book, Angela's Ashes, about growing up in an impoverished Catholic family in Ireland, won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the L.A. Times Book Award. He's also author of Tiz. His new book is Teacher Man. Frank McCourt, thanks very much for being with us.
How are you, Tom?
Very well. And here you are, back on the hustings, with a long account of those long years. Does it feel like you're back in front of the blackboard talking about this all the time?
Yeah, it is. But it's a very strange feeling after you've been out of teaching for a while and you write a book about it, you go back into it, and you go around the way I'm going around now, and you appear here and you appear there, and next thing, they pop up, former students.
Oh, yeah.
That's the strangest thing and the most gratifying thing of all. And you're grateful maybe that you had some effect on their lives.
We want to hear about those years of teaching. You tell it in a very interesting, funny, sometimes sad way. But you write also about what your years have been like since you left teaching, came out with Angela's Ashes, how that took this life. What you started teaching, making $4,000-something a year, ended making $38,000 a year, princely sum, not, you say. And then hit this typhoon of success with Angela's Ashes. How's it changed you and your life, Frank McCourt?
Well, it happened to me very late in life, Tom. If it had happened to me, say, in my 30s, I'd be dead now. I'd take the money and I'd go running around chasing women, drinking all night. And I'd be like Brendan Behan and Dylan Thomas and other people like that. And I didn't have the wisdom to handle it. So I'm a bit older. Considerably older. I was 66 when Angela's Ashes was published, and now I'm 75, so I can't stay out all night. So I think maybe I've acquired a little wisdom, and maybe my age and biology have told me to slow down. But still, it's a fantastic way to spend your golden years.
What you describe, and it's true, as a media darling, your opinion sought on everything. You also, in your inimitable way, describe yourself as a man who became the Mick of the moment, the old slang, and sometimes derogatory slang for the Irish. What do you mean by the Mick of the moment? Is there a mold, a phenomenon you're talking about there?
Well, you know, there are some Irishmen and women who become international. You can't turn around without seeing the name Bono. Well, because he's a rock star, because he's an activist. And then there's Liam Neeson and Pierce Brosnan. Of course, I'm as handsome as any of them.
Of course.
So they rose up, and then Jim Sheridan, the director, and Terry George, the director. All these people rose up in the 80s and the 90s, and I came along in 96. And I suppose I'm the oldest of this whole crowd. But each of them, got international recognition. I never expected that I'd write a book that would be translated into 30 languages. So I wanted to call myself Mick of the Millennium. But I think there's a lot of competition
far.
There.
But why? I wanted to ask you why that is. You've got this phrase, the Mick of the Moment. Of course, it's French, catchy, but we don't always have a... you know, a Somali of the moment, or a Bangladeshi of the moment, or even an American of the moment? What is it about the Irish that throws up these characters that grab people's attention, like Frank McCourt, like Bono?
I think for a long time, Tom, and a resident of Boston would know about this, and in New England, there were signs put out early in the century that said, "No Irish need apply."
Yep.
Because the Irish were what you might call the Mexicans of their time. They were coming in, they were dirty, they were brawling, they were drinking, and they were rowdy, and nobody wanted anything to do with them. They certainly couldn't get into a place like Harvard. And they were barred from the fine drawing rooms of Boston and places like that. But then they fought their way into politics in Boston. Remember the late famous or infamous James Curley, mayor of Boston, and governor of Massachusetts, congressman. So, and there was a kind of hostility towards the Irish where there is towards other ethnic groups. But then along comes glamorous John F. Kennedy, who makes it to the Oval Office, and his gorgeous wife. Mm-hmm. And then the Irish are not only accepted but exalted. And there's a word in American, in culture, that opens doors, and that is sexy. Sexy. I read this someplace a few years ago. The Irish suddenly became sexy and desired and desirable. So that's what's happened in recent history.
But you came to it out of a lifetime of teaching that gave you some things and didn't give you some things. You say, Frank McCourt, you write, "If I hadn't written Angela's Ashes, I would have died begging." What do you mean?
Yeah. It was the book that I wanted to write after the 30 years of teaching. And after the kids prodded me and nudged me into telling stories about my life, and then sometimes I would go off into fantasies of various kinds, but that was the main thing. I was supposed to be running these writing classes at Stuyvesant High School, and digging into autobiographical material, and they wanted me. They said that I was very fortunate, that I had a miserable childhood,
something to write about.
They all they had was middle class, upper middle class education, the inevitable road to college and graduation and success in whatever career it was, and they felt deprived of being deprived. Whatever the hell that means. They said that they envied me my miserable childhood. I thought that was hilarious.
But you would have died begging, meaning what? I mean, you had a modest teacher's pension, no doubt, coming to you, but it wasn't really money you would have died begging for, is that
right? No. It was to do the one thing that I'd wanted to do for years and years and years, to write that book. That's what I wanted to do. You're lucky if you have a dream of something you want to do. You're also cursed if there's something you want to, because you'll never satisfy it. I could have retired from teaching, Tom. I could have. That was 1987.
Mm-hmm.
I could have gone off and just found some cheap place to live.
Got a little trailer in Florida.
Yeah. Oh God, no, please. That's the entrance, the waiting room to eternity. I would have gone to some more, maybe Mexico or something like that,
mm-hmm.
or maybe some part of Europe, or even Ireland. But there was this itch, not an itch, an obsession to write this book. And after having gathered together the material as a storyteller in my classroom, it was there in my head. So then writing a book is not easy. But then in 1994, after being married to Ellen, Ellen Fry of Los Angeles, I sat down and started writing it. I'm not saying it poured out. It came out, but I had notebooks, which I never consulted for some reason. That's very strange, that it was all in my head, and I finished it in 13 months.
Well, you know,
great thing.
How quickly it poured out. But you know, just on that point, reading your book of these decades teaching, it seems to me, Frank McCourt, you may owe those students some cut in your royalties. I mean, they were your trial audience, where you polished these stories year after year after year.
Yeah. Well, it's true. The Board of Education in New York should have charged me for tuition. I was teaching myself, or they were teaching me, and that's true. I suppose I could send. I had if
a small
I had
check in the mail for every former
yeah,
student.
Yeah, for everybody. The check is in the mail, kids. 12,000 of you, but don't hold your breath.
Right, we've got a break coming up. But remind us of the of course, millions know it from Angela's Ashes, but of the framework of your life that made this possible. How you started out in the U.S., then back to Ireland, and then back here to a teaching career. How did that unfold?
Well, since I was born in New York, I was taken to Ireland when I was nearly 4 years of age and stayed there till I was 19 and had a kind of a stereotypical poverty-stricken childhood and with an education that was mainly memorization conveyed with brutality. And then there was the powerful influence of the church, which I'm still trying to sort out how deep it got into our psyches. And then I came to a variety of jobs in New York, worked at the Biltmore Hotel, which at that time was famous as a gathering place for the young bucks and maidens of the Ivy League. They were coming to New York, and I worked there, emptying their ashtrays. And then I hated it. I hated that job. But I didn't know what to do with myself. I had no high school education or anything. I didn't know how to make my way in society. But I was rescued, Tom, by the Chinese.
By the Chinese, no less.
The Chinese Chinese invaded Korea, and the United States got nervous and drafted me. And they didn't send me to Korea. They sent me to Germany, where I spent 2 years training German shepherd dogs, which was great preparation for teaching.
Frank, hold the thought right there, if you would. We're going to come back and hear much more. Frank McCord is with us, author of Angela's Ashes and Tis. We're talking about his third memoir, A Chronicle of Life and His Teaching Days in New York City. You can join us. Have you discovered yourself, your Irishness, your humanity in the many memoirs of Frank McCord? And what is it about this man, his voice, his view of the world that's captured so many millions of fans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Frank McCord, author of Angela's Ashes and Tis, about his third memoir. It's called Teacher Man. It's about his 30 years teaching in New York City. Serial memoirist at this point. You can join the conversation. Are you drawn to the tales of suffering of Frank McCord or to his humor? And can you imagine this being your high school English teacher? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. When we last met Frank McCord, he was in Germany training German shepherds. And then suddenly he was in a high school classroom on Staten Island, NYU, in between. Why teaching, Frank?
Well, when I came back from the Army, I didn't know what to do with myself. Again, there was a series of jobs, which were, physically, they were very satisfying because I worked all day loading and unloading trucks and ships down in the docks. But then I said, this is not my life. Because I used to see young people in the subways in New York carrying books and bags from Fordham and Columbia and so on. And I said, that's what I want. I want to get an education. But I felt very frustrated. I didn't see myself getting into any university. And somebody told me, well, you have to get a high school diploma. That would mean going nights for about 5 or 6 years because I couldn't go days.
You didn't have a high school diploma because of your back and forth across the
Atlantic.
I
never set foot in a high school until I started teaching in one. Mm-hmm. One day I just made my way to NYU. I was desperate. And I filled out this admissions form, and they were very amused because I didn't put in my high school, and they said, "Oh, well, how can you?
Where's that?
Think
of
going." But the admissions dean, this was luck, pure stroke of luck, was passing by at that moment, and she wanted to know what all this fuss was, and I said, "I'm trying to apply, but I said I think I can do it. I think I'm intelligent." You know, this was very brazen of me because I was generally very shy about such things, and I said, "I've read a lot of books." I thought that's how you talk to university people. And she said, "Oh, yeah, what books have you read?" And I said, "Dickens." And then I came up with one of the big guns, Dostoevsky, which always impresses people.
Of course.
And then I clinched it with James Joyce. And her eyebrows.
And you were in.
You know, no, Nobody reads James Joyce. Nobody can understand him. And she, I don't know, she was impressed. And she let me in on a year's probation. If I maintained a B average, then I could matriculate.
And, on
and
did.
I did.
And,
yeah.
and you did it, and you went right on. You know,
and then I had to decide what to do with myself, yeah. so I thought it would be teaching.
And we'll hear how you went off and began doing that. But there's something I wanted to ask you here, because I've always, I mean, you become such a presence, not only in your books, but an audible presence. You did your own books on tape. As I recall, you won a Grammy?
I was nominated for a Grammy.
For a Grammy.
I nearly met Elton John.
Nearly.
I nearly met Whitney Houston.
Yeah, you're right about it. On the other side of this teaching career, here you are kissing the ring of the Pope and meeting Gregory Peck and presidents.
Yeah.
But that voice, you know, I have to tell you, you know, it's sometimes been an affliction to me. After people listen to your books on tape, they go around talking like Frank McCourt for weeks. It's absolutely infectious. But you write about how when you first went back to Ireland, you were very young. You were mocked in Irish schools for your American accent from New York.
That's
hard to imagine now. And then you determinedly then picked up a Limerick accent, your Irish accent, which has stayed with you ever since. Has that been deliberate? I mean, you were mocked for having the other one.
No, it wasn't deliberate. When you're a little kid in school, you automatically pick up the accent that's around you. I didn't. I was mocked, all right, but the accent, the American accent, disappeared very soon. So I soon had the Limerick accent, myself and my brother. So, and then I come back to New York with the Limerick accent. I come back to America. And there are friends of mine who had similar stories, but they very quickly got rid of their Irish accents. And there were times when I didn't want to be recognized as an Irishman. You know, people, oh, your accent, you Irish. I didn't want all that fuss. And I tried to put on an American accent. But one of my girlfriends sends it. She had a peculiar remark that she said, you sound like Edward G. Robinson underwater. Whatever the hell that means.
And that was that.
Yeah.
And then there you were at Staten Island in the McKee School, a vocational training school.
Yeah.
I was struck. I mean, it seems almost the first order of business in many of your years of teaching was simply to keep order in the class, and you found you could do it by, in a sense, charming them with stories. Were you a good teacher?
They discovered that. They knew how to stop me from trying to teach a lesson on grammar or spelling or vocabulary or reading comprehension. These kids have been in school most of their lives, and they're experts on how to handle teachers, the psychology of a teacher. You walk into a room as a new teacher, and they sort you out right away, and they say, well, they decide whether to let you live or kill you. And so they give me a break, I think, because of my accent. I didn't know my way around. I'd never been in a high school. What did I know? So they said, I think I wrote on the board spelling and vocabulary or something like that. And the hand went up. Yo, teach, you Scotch or something? And that was it. That was the turning point of my life. No, I'm Irish. And what's Irish? And that led to anecdotes and stories, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, for the next 30 years. But I did. I told my stories, but I also tried to teach that strange subject called English, whatever it is.
In a sense, spinning out Angela's ashes over all those years. And it begins, and I know you've told this many times, story recently, but it begins with the bologna sandwich story on your first day in a classroom.
Yeah, this kid in the back of the room calls out, hey, anybody want a bologna sandwich? Another kid says in the front, Andy, says, yeah, your mother must hate you, giving you bologna sandwiches. So Petey throws the sandwich at Andy. It misses Andy, lands on the floor in front of my desk, and it's there. And I said, now, what do I do now? Because this is my, you know, this is my first problem.
And it's already out of hand, the classroom.
Yeah, what am I going to do? And all the stuff is going through my head. Should I tell Petey to get up there and pick up that sandwich or else? Or should I throw it into the garbage myself to show my contempt for people who forget there are a million starving and all this stuff? And then there's nothing in the education courses at NYU that teaches you how to handle
the flying
sandwich
bologna
situation.
Right.
So I picked it up. not knowing what I was going to do with it. Should I throw it in the garbage? But it was so aromatic, Tom. I swooned over the fragrance of this. But it was better. It was more than bologna. There was sliced tomatoes and onions and relish in it. And, oh, God.
You
and
made me hungry. Your description of it made me want that sandwich.
I
have to say.
Ate the sandwich. What are you supposed to do? I couldn't throw it away. And then, of course, the kids are sitting there gawking at me. What's going on here? They've never seen the likes of this before. He picks the sandwich off the floor and eats it. And it was dead quiet in the class. And the principal, of course, has to be passing the room at that moment and sees me standing there chewing on this sandwich and beckons me to come and see him in his office, which I did. And I was called on the carpet for eating lunch at 9 o'clock in the morning in front of a senior class at McKee High School. That was, and then the word went around the school and they would nudge and point in the hallways. There he goes. Watch out for your sandwich.
Frank McCourt, Mr. McCourt will eat your sandwich. Frank McCourt is with us. His new book is Teacher Man. Frank McCourt, lots of listeners want to join this conversation. Let me turn to them. Steve is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you all doing today?
Very well.
Hi, Steve.
How are you, Mr. McCourt? I just wanted to
tell
you that... What's that, sir?
I'm fine.
Oh, okay, good. I just wanted to tell you that if I had been one of your high school students, I probably never would have graduated hearing the stories in person. I've always been proud of my Irish heritage, and when I read Angela's Ashes, it kind of reawakened all over. In fact, you inspired the names of my children. They all have Irish names. My wife drew the line on Seamus and Malachi, but we have Liam and Aaron and Ryan and Siobhan and
beautiful names.
Your newest book. I haven't read your newest book, but I just wanted to tell you that you know your writing is just incredible, and it's helped my wife and I put a lot of perspective on what Americans would classify as you know a period where we thought we were destitute, and how much we actually had compared to what you were able to make do with and your family was, which was just incredible.
Oh, Steve, thank you so much for that, and thanks
for
your call.
Thank you very much.
Frank McCourt, how about it? The Irish Americans and their response to your books and the light that it shone on Ireland. The culture of the country. Do they tend to come to you with Steve's attitude? Thank you, reawakened me, or something else?
Because I think, despite the stereotype as the Irish has been a sociable, sometimes rowdy race of people and so on, there's a great reserve among the Irish in Ireland, and because we were taught, it has something to do with religion too. Tell your sins to the priest; they're not for public consumption. So, but. A lot of people then told me, a lot of Irish Americans told me, it opened up family history, because a lot of the older people, my generation and even older, didn't want to talk about the past because it was so painful. But this Angela's Ashes, I think, opened doors to history and conditions in Ireland. And it has, for a lot of people, created a line of communication between one generation and an older generation.
Let's get a
That's
call.
Very gratifying.
It is gratifying. Let's get a call from Boston and Dermot there. Hi, Dermot. You're on the air.
Hi, Frank. How you doing?
Hello, Dermot. How are you?
Hi, Frank. I'm from Cork, and I grew up in the 60s and the 70s in Ireland. And I remember after Angela's Ashes came out, when I went back to Ireland on holidays, people were saying, oh, Jesus, it was never that bad in Ireland. it was never that poverty.
Yeah.
Because I remember for this in my class, like, Christ, you know, things weren't much better, like, you know what I mean, than they were back in the 40s. Yeah. I mean, they were better, but I could really understand how things were back then, you know?
So you think Frank McCourt got it, Dermot? He nailed it. He got it right.
I think he got it nailed on the head, but a lot of the Irish people, like, they got indignant to say, oh, my God, things could never have been that bad back then, you know what I mean?
Yes, we can fully understand that. Frank McCourt, how about it? When you go back on the other side of the pond, do you get that kind of guff?
Well, you know, Tom, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. that the negative always gets more prominence in the media than the positive. So there were critics, and they got the attention. But the fact is, the book Angel's Ashes was leaping off the shelves in the bookstores over there. I was given an honorary degree by the University of Limerick, received by the Mayor of Limerick. Good reviews everywhere, but from certain people in Limerick.
Yeah,
and the one place that I was nervous about was England. I thought, the English would be saying, oh, here we go again, another story of Irish misery and Catholicism.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, the book got on the bestseller list and I've been warmly received. As a matter of fact, I'm going to London tonight because the book has been launched there, and already there are terrific reviews.
Oh, well, good for you. Good for you. Yeah. Annie's calling from Boston. Hi, Annie, you're on the air.
I just want to thank Mr. McCourt for such wonderful writing, and I'm a teacher here in Boston,
yeah.
And want to thank you for giving teachers the example of being a writer and a teacher. I think especially English teachers, you know, if you can be in the practice of writing stories, it's much easier to teach people to write stories. So, but I wanted to ask a question. In the popular media, the images we see of teaching are so... They don't really seem like teachers to those of us who teach. We watch that Boston Public show and laugh.
Yeah.
They really seem like guidance counselors gone mad.
Yeah.
Actually teachers.
And they don't teach.
No, they don't. And the actual business of what we sit down to do every day is just not that dramatic. You know, it's like how much of a half-hour show can you get out of somebody marking papers?
No.
So I guess I wanted to ask how you went about telling the stories of your daily life as a teacher. And making it something that would be dramatic and maybe convey, hopefully, I'm looking forward to reading it, hopefully convey the daily life of a teacher rather than something that, the Hollywood version of it.
But you may have, Annie, a little bit of a Hollywood version in Frank McCourt. I don't know if he's actually sort of, run of the factory product here for teachers. Frank, are you different? I mean, you're telling stories about amazing stories in here.
I know, but Anne will know when she goes into the classroom today. She knows that sitting in front of her as dozens and dozens of dramatic stories. There's always something going on in the classroom, and sometimes teachers become discouraged. But you never know what you're doing for them or to them. But you certainly know what they're doing to you. Or for you, and there is what she's getting at. She's circling around the image of the teacher in America, which now is my topic, my subject that I go on about. Because I'm on here on this program. Mm-hmm. But when did you last see a teacher on a television talk show? Never.
Probably a while. Yeah, I don't know who. Unless there was a mass. Maybe at Columbine got them all.
That has to be dramatic, or a teacher has to be caught for abusing a child or something like that. Although they're not brought on. You'll see on all these late night shows, David Letterman and Jay Leno, all these. You see football players, basketball players, comedians. Actors, and most of all, politicians.
So why is that? Why do you think teachers are absent?
Because the media have not learned to explore this tremendously rich territory. Every teacher, and Anne can tell you that every teacher has a million stories. Kids are always acting up. They're forthright, they're frank, they're rowdy and so on, they're emotional. But the teachers are too busy to advance their own cause. They don't have agents to go around and say, here, Miss Jones at public school, blah blah blah, is a terrifically gifted raconteur. No, they don't, because you go in, you do your job, you keep the kid. You're dealing with the most precious material in the country, the children. But all attention is paid to politicians. Well, you know, at campaign time, Tom, you see these. And politicians going into classrooms, brushing the teacher aside.
To sit with the students.
The ends of the world are standing over there in the corner with this kind of grim smile, while the teacher sits there, or the politician starts telling the kid, reading a story about a goat or something like that, while the world is collapsing. Or another, or a vice president comes in and teaches the kids how to misspell potato. But that's the photo op for the politician. Meanwhile, the teachers class has been taken advantage of, and the politician leaves, and that's the end of that. Because the journalists rarely go into the classroom to discover this rich level of American life. That's my speech.
But somehow, I imagine that if the TV camera had been brought into Frank McCourt's class, the class that I read described in the book, Teacher Man, they would have found the material they're looking for there. You were not, as far as I can see, a kind of a standard issue teacher. It was all about stories and drama in many ways. We have to take a short break. I want to come back and hear some of those stories that hook the students into your classes. My guest is Frank McCourt, author of Angela's Ashes and Tis, his third memoir out now, a chronicle of life and his teaching days in New York City. It's called Teacher Man. You can join the conversation. How would Frank McCourt fit into No Child Left Behind in our teaching to the test model today? What do you think? And what's the heart of the character you hear in Frank McCourt? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Our guest is Frank McCourt, author of Angela's Ashes and Tears. His new book is Teacher Man. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. What have you taken from the books of Frank McCourt? Can you picture him at the front of your classroom? 1-800-423-TALK. Frank McCourt joins us this hour from San Francisco. Lonnie is calling right now from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Lonnie. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to say it's an honor to be able to speak to Mr. McCourt. And if there was anyone in the world I could share a pint of Guinness with, it would be him.
I'm your man.
but of all the hundreds of books I've read, I'm right now reading Ulysses, and I'm halfway through it, and I've still not figured out what I've read.
Wow.
Well, teacher comfort, man, what do you have to say? Comfort Lonnie. Guide him here.
Reading Joyce is like living with somebody. You never know them, especially women. The mystery is always there, but I think Joyce himself said in his humble way, I expect people to devote their lives to my work. Can you imagine that? But Ulysses, I think you can't read Ulysses by itself. I think you need some, there are guides to Ulysses, and it works on various levels. You know, it's based loosely on the Odyssey. So good luck to you.
Yes, I really enjoyed Dubliners and Portrait of a Young Man, but this one's a pretty tough read. But
it
was nice to be able to speak to you, Mr. McCourt.
Oh, thank you very much.
Lonnie, thanks for your call. Frank McCourt, give us a sample of how you use the stories, maybe some of the stories you knew from Angela Ashes or later or others, to pull your classes, your students in. What would you throw out that would begin to sort of hook them into Mr. McCourt's class?
I think in the beginning, Tom, I didn't deliberately get in there and start telling stories. They would have to ask me because I always felt somewhat guilty over using class time to tell stories. At the same time, I realized the value of telling stories, that it got their attention. It was a human situation. They wanted to know about teachers. And I became, later on, I became clever at leading them from my stories into their stories and into the subject matter, whatever it was. Maybe at one time we were reading Catcher in the Rye, and we'd go around the room with their stories, my stories, and there was always this feeling of rebellion among adolescents, and I understood their feelings because I was often frustrated myself, but I learned that the main thing that I learned from the 30 years of teaching was how you have to be honest with them. They know, as I said before, they're veterans of the classroom. They know when you're putting on a mask, when you're being a big phony, when you're not being honest. So I learned to drop the mask and to be straightforward with them and admit to them from time to time or frequently that I didn't know anything about English grammar or anything like that. And I said to them, we're all in the same boat. They love that, the idea of being in the same boat with a teacher admitting his ignorance.
And bringing it to them through stories, a kind of understanding. But well, you're sort of dodging us on where you'd take them down the paths of childhood in Limerick. Where would you go in?
First of all, if I was able to get copies of Oliver Twist, there's Dickens writes in a very eloquent way about poverty, and I get them into that. It was all seduction, Tom. Teaching is a form of seduction. And you want, especially in a vocational high school in those days, you want to lure them into this, what they call the subject matter. And I was making my way. That's what it was, because I didn't have any set philosophy of education. I didn't know my way around high schools. I'd never been in one until I started teaching. So they were complicit in this. They were with me. They were my brothers and sisters in arms as I made my way through the day from one class to another. And the thing is that I was learning on the job.
Yeah.
They thought I was teaching. I thought I was teaching. I was learning.
And arguing with yourself, you say in the book, this kind of internal dialogue of Frank McCourt, I'm teaching. Storytelling is teaching. No, storytelling is a waste of time. I can't help it. I'm not good at lecturing. You're a fraud. Again, your internal conversation. You're cheating our children. They don't seem to think so. The poor kids don't know. Let's go to the source, Frank McCourt. We have, as you say, your former students do call in. We've got one. Gabrielle's calling from Boston. Hi, Gabrielle. You're on the air.
Hi. I just have to say that Mr. McCourt was absolutely as fabulous a teacher as you would imagine.
Oh. Where was he your teacher,
Call more
Gabrielle?
Often. Call more often, Gabrielle.
Oh.
Where did you have him and when, Gabrielle?
At Stuyvesant back in the 80s, in the early 80s. And, I mean, if you had Mr. McCourt in the morning, your friends who had him in the afternoon wanted to know, what story did he tell you? What was the end of yesterday's story? What happened with his brother Malachi? And, you know, we just were wrapped.
And so when he became internationally renowned with Angela's Ashes, were you surprised or did you see it coming?
None of us were surprised at all. I think when any of us heard about his book, we all thought, well, that's got to be successful. You know, we all love those stories.
I can tell you today that I'm walking on air because this morning in the New York Times in the letters to the editor, there's a letter from a former student named Tanya Augsburg talking about how the effect that I had on her as a writer and a teacher and so on. And I feel, my God, this is what it's all about. This is what teaching is all about. And rarely do teachers get this kind of after career attention. So the Gabriel's calling up make me want to sing.
Gabrielle, you wanted to go to the class. You wanted to hear his stories. Was he a good English teacher?
He was a great English teacher. I don't think I will ever use the word basically when I write something. I remember it was on the list not to use.
On Frank McCourt's forbidden words. Gabrielle, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you, Gabrielle.
Frank McCourt, you say that you found these types in classrooms, and in a way we all know them, but I wish you'd kind of take us through that. Every class had a sort of cast of characters that you came to know and anticipate. Yeah. What were some of those, and what were the characters like?
There was always the class clown, and I think in his day George Carlin was the class clown. He had
surely
an album.
Was. Yeah.
There was the goody-goody. There was the scholar. There was the sexually disoriented kid. There was the religious fanatic. Then there was the avid, the powerful atheist, and then there was the great lover. Then there was, and then there were all shades. So you found all of these, all of the above, in certain kids. So you had to, there were characters in the classroom, and if you liked what you were doing, if you liked the teaching, if you liked the kids, you'd find them an eternal source, a constant source of amusement and information.
And you write about how you snagged kids with an assignment. You developed a drawer full of unbelievable excuses that were sent in.
Yeah.
By. I wish you'd give some of those and describe the assignment that eventually grew out of that.
Well, they were in one of the classes. They were taking a test one day. I saw him sitting up at the desk, and they're grinding away at the test. And I look in the drawer, and I have this drawer filled with excuse notes, going back a year or two, and I start looking at these excuse notes, and then I realize, I started reading them, I said, my God, this is really powerful American prose.
And this is why Johnny didn't come to school, or why he didn't have his homework.
Yeah, excuses for not coming to school, excuses for being late, excuses for being tardy, and the rest of it. And I knew, they knew, everybody knew, these were all forgeries. That the kids wrote the notes on behalf of their parents and signed them on behalf of their parents. But the ordinary parent would write, Johnny was late for school today because the alarm clock didn't go off, or something like that.
Yeah.
But the kids weren't content with that. They would write these very dramatic excuse notes. For instance, Johnny didn't have his homework today because his bag caught in the subway train and the train moved away, and he yelled to the conductor, and the conductor said very vulgar things and something should be done. Or he couldn't go to school yesterday because there was an epidemic of diarrhea in the family. Or the old man died in the bathtub upstairs and it overflowed and came down on Susan's homework on the table. They were crazy, wild, fantastic. And I said, my God, this is tremendous stuff. And there was one kid named Mikey Doyle, and he's sitting in front of me one day actually forging a note.
In front of you?
Right in front of me. And I was looking at him because he was writing with his left hand. And I realized what he was doing. He was disguising his handwriting because he had come from a Catholic school where there's great insistence on good handwriting. The nuns don't care what you do. You could marry a Protestant or renounce the faith or anything as long as you have good handwriting. And Mikey had the best handwriting in the school because of his Catholic training. So here he is writing with his left hand, writing an excuse note. And I knew what he was up to. But I took the excuse notes, and I typed some of them I typed up some of them and reproduced them and handed them out. And the kids said, "What's this?" I said, "Excuse notes." And they were bewildered. They said, "Who wrote them?" I said, "You did, or somebody in this class."
Yeah.
So I changed the names to protect the guilty. And then we started reading them, and we realized these notes are forceful and powerful and fantastic and creative and lying.
But you took it a step further. You had them write excuses, if I understand right.
Yeah.
Write me an excuse for Attila the Hun, for Lee Harvey Oswald, Judas, for Al Capone.
Or from Adam to God. Or
Adam and Eve.
Adam and Eve, explaining why they carried on like that in the Garden of Eden, why they ate the apple and so on. But the kids went wild, and I had them write these things in class, and the bell rang for lunchtime, and they sat there, Tom. They sat there writing. Oh, no, the other one I did was, I said, imagine a few years from now, you have a 15-year-old son or daughter.
Yeah.
And that son or daughter needs an excuse note for falling behind in English. So they sat there and they wrote in a way that I'd never seen them write before. This was a matter of loyalty, family union. So, and the bell rang, and I had to push them out of the room to go to lunch. I'd never seen anything like that. And that was early in my career. And that was a very, it became a branch to me of American literature.
A young teacher's breakthrough, the excuse note.
And then what I didn't have in the book was I had them write obituaries. Well, that was hilarious because they weren't too keen on writing their own obituaries.
Mm.
They were a little more enthusiastic about writing obituaries of people in the school they didn't like. And when I had them write obituaries of a teacher, they went wild. They had no teacher died peacefully in bed. They were falling off cliffs. There would be spots swallowed by boa constrictors which suddenly appeared in the Staten Island. It was great.
That's wonderful. Priscilla is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Priscilla. You're on the air.
Yes, Mr. McCourt, I used to go to Stuyvesant. You were my sister's teacher and mine. Before Angela Ashes came out, I used to tell my husband that I had this great English teacher who would read stories to us that he had written about his childhood. And then when Angela Ashes came out, I have a copy, but I haven't touched it yet because I almost don't want to be disappointed.
You won't be.
Take it from
Mr. McCord.
But, that's not what my question is, mm-hmm. Mr. McCord. You struck me as being very unhappy, actually, when I used to attend your classes. But when I hear and see you today, you seem very happy. What's changed in your life? Was it before Angela's Ashes or after Angela's Ashes? You just seem an almost different person.
Oh, now we're down to it. Priscilla, thanks, Frank. What do you say?
Oh. Well, I suppose when I was teaching, I had this urge to write all the time. But I didn't have the time. If you're teaching all day and you have papers to correct, and so you don't have time. That's all. And I felt frustrated, and I said, "Oh, I'd like to just quit and go off and become a busboy or a waiter for 4 hours a day." But I was getting deeper and deeper into teaching, and I was frustrated because I would take home these papers from the Priscillas of the world and correct them and so on. And I just felt I was when will I get around to writing? Some of my students were already publishing articles and stuff in magazines and newspapers. And I said, oh, well, that's... And then I felt they're looking at me and they're saying, well, what has he ever done? He's talking about writing. What has he ever done? And I just felt frustrated and because I had a lot of friends who were writers, journalists, Pete Hamill, that I used to hang out with in the Lion's Head Bar in the Village. And that was it. I was torn into... Actually, going into the classroom, if I did give off this feeling of unhappiness, the classroom was what saved me. Because going into the classroom, you have to forget your life outside because you're facing... You're facing 175 kids every day. But I made it. I learned a lot. I think I was very aware. Maybe I was aware of the fact that I was learning on the job. And then when I retired, I was able to write the book. And I'm particularly happy that I wrote Teacher Man because that's, in a way, almost sums up 30 years of teaching.
Mm. Priscilla, thank you so much for your call. Paul is calling from Franklin, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Frank. It's great to listen to you today. Excuse my voice.
Thank you.
A bit of a cold. I'm from Belfast, and it's very inspiring to listen to you today. I'm a teacher myself. I teach at Boston University for the Prison Education Program.
And you're a saint.
And I teach a writing composition class at Curry College.
Yeah.
But just want to say to you that my students, my prisoners who are working towards their degree, and the prisoners absolutely love your book. And we have great discussions about it, and it inspires them, and it's just such a big hit.
What do they love about it, Paul?
I think they love the humor in it, and I think they love that you overcame, you know, a very difficult life, but you've written it in a way that doesn't judge anyone. It's not sentimental, and it's you know, I like the they like one of the issues I give them is, you know, hope overcoming adversity. And my question really today for you, Frank, is. When the young kids I work with, I get a bit disillusioned because they don't want to read books anymore. They're not interested, and writing is a big chore for them. And I'd just like to know what your response to that is, young people today, and what, where they are about reading and writing.
We've got 1 minute for the answer. We're glad to have the question. Frank McCord.
Well, I used to use newspapers. I didn't care. Sensational headlines. I get them to read newspapers and talk about the stories and talk about point of view and balance in a story and an editorial. They like that, and it stirred up a lot of controversy, argument in the classroom. How one newspaper can take this point of view, how another newspaper can take that point of view, how is it these grown people, journalists, can have different points of view. I just use newspapers and magazines, popular culture. I didn't try to get into what we might call literature. And then you might find this very valuable, then I used to ask them, what did you do on a Saturday morning? And invariably, 99% of them watch cartoons. And this was an education for me, and it would be for you because you grew up in Belfast. What do American kids do on a Saturday morning? And they came up with all these cartoons, Roadrunner and Bugs Bunny and the rest, hundreds and hundreds, and I asked, what's their favorite? And then I'd slide slowly, in my clever way, into the Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen and fairy tales in general, and lead them in that direction. So that was very effective.
And on down that road, and now Paul's teaching prisoners to read those tough stories of your childhood and take encouragement from them. Frank McCord, the new book is Teacher Man. We're out of time. It's been great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.